Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. And today is part two of a two-part series, and it's called, where today's program is focusing on dealing with the side effects of metastatic prostate cancer treatments. Very important program today, and we have really wonderful speakers, multidisciplinary from different disciplines, to address the different side effects that you may be experiencing. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 422 participants, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, India, Nepal, Syria, and the United Kingdom. So you really, it's a global call. You're from all over the world. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program has actually been supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Services, LLC. And I really would like to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about each of the speakers, there's information about the topics we'll be covering, and also information about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for all of you when the call concludes. And we also have in there an evaluation form that I would encourage you to complete. Indeed, the topics that we choose, we're now entering, we'll be planning all of our programs for 2012, will really depend upon your feedback. And so indeed, the program today was, the topics that we've chosen for this program today was one that many of you have asked for in previous programs. So again, you are our best, you're the best people to tell us what we should be offering in our in the workshops to keep them most relevant to meet your needs. So thank you for that. And we have wonderful speakers, and so I'm going to start by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. She's Associate Attending Physician, Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to address, give you a kind of an overview of metastatic prostate cancer and treatment side effects. She's going to talk about strategies to talk with your healthcare team about managing side effects, access to coordinated care for African American and Hispanic men, and the role of clinical trials and how research contributes to your treatment options. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm once again charged with a monumentous task of telling you everything you need to know in a very short time, but good afternoon to all. I am very privileged today to have on the call with me three very distinguished colleagues, truly part of a multidisciplinary group of which we're very proud over at Memorial Sloan Kettering. You're going to have the opportunity to speak with these people and ask questions. But my job today is to really act as sort of a liaison to really tell you what have been issues that patients have discussed with me in the past. Keep in mind, patients are now living longer. And we have wonderful new drugs that are out there that have made a difference in patients' quality of life, their ability to maintain their normal milestones. And despite the fact that they're living longer, remember there are competing medical problems that have nothing to do with their cancer. Competing problems include diabetes, which can cause peripheral vascular disease, problems with erectile dysfunction. Patients may have cardiac issues where medications, again, prevent them from being able to achieve erections. Strokes, any number of medical issues can really be part and parcel of treatment along with the patient's cancer. Among those issues, now, keep in mind that today we're talking about patients who have had metastatic disease, but remember, even if disease means that you have failed surgery or radiation or both and have nothing more than a rising PSA or you have failed hormonal therapy or have failed chemotherapy, at some point, perhaps, you will have experienced, either early or late in the course of your treatment, one or many of the following side effects. So many people, as they get older, may have problems with osteoporosis or osteopenia, which is loss of bone mass, that is, and that can be just from being on hormonal therapy. But over time, particularly for patients who have gone through multiple treatments and have been exposed to certain classes of chemotherapy drugs, patients may experience numbness and tingling in their fingers and toes, what we call neuropathy, for which we have made referrals to both neurology and pain service for assistance. Over time, patients may have problems with bleeding in their urine, and that can be from a variety of different reasons that Dr. Sandu will address. Pain, another issue that may be related to the patient's cancer or may be related to good old-fashioned degenerative arthritis, can also be a major issue, and it's upon us to really determine what it is that's causing the pain. I would say that most patients who have metastatic disease often have a concurrent history of good old-fashioned degenerative arthritis or osteoarthritis, and it gets very hard sometimes to figure out what's really causing the pain. Is it disease? Is it just the weather or just changing? Urinary retention is another problem. Sometimes patients have weak or neurogenic bladders just from age or diabetes, and those are other issues. Erectile dysfunction is a major concern for many people. Sometimes it's medication-related. Sometimes it's a result of what our treatments are doing to the patient, or they may be a result of surgery. But what is wonderful now, what we have now that we didn't have years ago, is a multidisciplinary team that can be available to assist you in every way. Part of what we do as medical oncologists and part of a larger multidisciplinary team at a cancer institution is try to make sure that we address everyone's problems. Sometimes we have patients who are truly unaware of the side effects of medications or what their expectations should be, and we try very, very hard, even in getting patients in to be evaluated, we try very, very hard to provide them with information regarding every treatment so that they are well prepared for any of the potential side effects that may occur. I often tell patients that when they go on hormonal therapy, for example, they can experience every single one of the side effects, none of the side effects, or perhaps one or two of the side effects, and whether or not you will be one of those people who have the problems or tolerate it very poorly or tolerate it well really remains to be determined. In going forward, sometimes we face the issue of patients whose treatments are not working as best as they can. Clinical trials still remain probably the most important approach toward getting drugs approved and also for benefiting patients. And I think perhaps the one thing that is important is acknowledging the fact that it's not just about cancer treatment that we use clinical trials. We use clinical trials in other disciplines, whether it's pain management or dealing with the problems of urinary incontinence or dealing with even erectile dysfunction. There are clinical trials that address those issues. And again, sometimes people are on the cutting edge by going into these trials where they have the opportunity to really receive treatments that may ultimately go to the FDA for approval. So while there's just so much to talk about today, I'm just going to take a respite at the moment and turn it back to Carolyn so that my colleagues can give you their wisdom. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, for just an outstanding overview of what we're going to be doing today and just excellent information for everybody on the call. And now my pleasure to introduce our next speaker. And our next speaker is Susan Derby. And Susan Derby is an oncology nurse, and she is with the Pain and Palliative Care Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Susan is going to address an overview of pain and neuropathy, how to control pain and neuropathy, and nutritional and physical activity concerns and tips. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Susan Derby.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure and honor for me to be part of this wonderful presentation. So this afternoon, what I'm going to do is present an overview of the goals of pain management and discuss the types of pain in patients with prostate cancer, metastatic prostate cancer, and review both the pharmacologic drug and non-pharmacologic treatments that are available for patients. So what you need to know before you start treatment for pain management is that you have a right to comprehensive pain management. Pain management is as important to your care as your cancer treatment, and in many instances, it will allow you to get through your cancer treatment. As the patient, you are the best one to report the severity of your pain and the amount of relief that you are experiencing. Your caregiver or spouse should also be included in your treatment plan. The goals of pain management are essentially to relieve pain and suffering and to improve the overall quality of your life. What you should expect from your doctors and nurses are that they believe your report of pain, that they have an understanding of why you're having pain, and as Dr. Slovin reiterated, not all types of pain are related to cancer. Many times older patients do have degenerative joint disease, and this can be extremely debilitating. It is also important that you expect care that is both comprehensive and compassionate. We know that chronic pain affects all aspects of your life. It impairs function, it affects your relationships, it can produce depression and anxiety, and it can also affect your sleep. Lastly, it can affect your ability to eat and in some cases maintain your weight. Pain in patients with metastatic prostate cancer can be caused by three things. It can be caused by the disease, namely the cancer. It can be caused by treatment such as chemotherapy, radiation therapy, or surgery, and it can be caused by other illnesses such as diabetes or herpes zoster, commonly known as shingles. Initially and ongoing, you should expect a thorough pain assessment where your doctor or nurse asks you questions about the location of your pain. They may ask you to describe your pain. Is it sharp? Is it dull? Is it burning? They will also ask you to rate your pain on a scale of 0 to 10, both at rest and with movement. And they may ask you questions about aggravating or relieving factors. What makes the pain better or worse? Pain caused by metastatic prostate cancer is divided into three types. The first type is called somatic pain, and this pain occurs when the disease has spread to the bone, and this is the most common type of pain we see in patients with prostate cancer. The second type of pain we see is visceral pain, and visceral pain occurs when the cancer has spread to abdominal organs or lymph nodes. The third type of pain that we see is nerve or neuropathic pain, and this occurs when there's injury to nerves from either disease or treatment. And nerve pain often feels different than these other two types of pain. Patients often describe this pain as burning, shooting, numbness, or electric shock-like. So let's talk about bone pain first. Bone metastasis can result and often does result in pain, spinal cord compression, or fracture. The mainstay of treatment of bone pain is pharmacologic, treatment with opioids, often known as narcotics, or other medications. Often, depending on the location of bone pain, your oncologist may recommend a referral to a radiation therapist for radiation therapy. Now let's talk a bit about nerve pain. Nerve pain can be related to other causes. It can be related to chemotherapy, where chemotherapy affects the nerves in your hands or feet, and these chemotherapy agents include Taxol, vincristine, vinblastine, cisplatinum, or carboplatin. Radiation therapy can produce damage to nerves, and this is also very painful in some patients. Patients undergoing surgical procedures can have pain as a result of the surgery itself. And other diseases such as shingles or herpes zoster, which commonly occur in cancer patients, can also produce pain. Neuropathic pain can also be tumor-related, such as when tumor invades large bundles of nerves in the body, such as the brachial or lumbosacral plexus. So let's move on to treatment. All treatments that your medical oncologist prescribe, including chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and monoclonal antibodies, can reduce pain by decreasing your tumor. Medications are the primary way we treat all types of cancer pain. So let's talk about the different medications we use. For patients with mild pain, we usually begin with Tylenol, acetaminophen, or if you can tolerate it, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent, such as Aleve or Motrin. For pain that is more continuous and chronic, opioids or narcotics are the mainstay of treatment and include morphine, Dilaudid, methadone, fentanyl, and oxycodone. If you have nerve pain, we may use other medications, including two categories, antidepressants or anticonvulsants. Antidepressants include drugs such as Elavil and Cymbalta, and anticonvulsants or anti-seizure medicines include drugs such as Neurontin or Lyrica. Bisphosphonates are another class of medications that may be prescribed by your medical oncologist to treat bone pain. These drugs include Zometa and Pimidronate, and these drugs suppress bone breakdown. They essentially strengthen the bone, increasing bone density, and reduce the risk of pathologic fracture. Radioisotopes are also used for patients who have multiple sites of bone pain, and these include agents such as strontium and samarium. And given intravenously, they deliver doses of radiation therapy to the bone through the emission of beta particles. External beam radiation therapy is often given to patients with metastatic prostate cancer to the bone because it targets just the painful area. It also prevents potential fracture and further injury to the bone and decreases the amount of opioid pain medicine you take and thus can decrease the side effects from opioids, including constipation, sedation, and confusion. Physical therapy can play an important role as an adjunct to other forms of pain relief, and your physical therapist can teach you ways to improve your balance and gait, to prevent further injury if you have peripheral neuropathy in the hands or feet. It can strengthen your muscles and prevent falls. Other interventions that can be used for the treatment of metastatic disease include procedures performed by an anesthesia pain doctor, such as nerve blocks, or the administration of medications through implanted pumps. Non-pharmacologic or non-drug options that many patients use include relaxation therapy, meditation, guided imagery, or acupuncture. Other things that you can do to manage your pain include wear comfortable clothing and shoes, evaluate your home for safety issues such as throw rugs and loose carpets, avoid standing for prolonged periods of time if you have neuropathy in your feet, use handrails in the shower or bath, protect your hands and feet when gardening or when washing dishes or in the bath. Take your medication as prescribed and keep track of its effectiveness. And lastly, if you are having difficulty eating and trouble maintaining your weight, it might be helpful to consult a nutritionist for assistance. In conclusion, it's important for you to expect careful assessment and comprehensive treatment for the management of your pain.
Thank you very much, Susan, for just an excellent presentation and just so informative around a lot of the details and the importance of really having a proper pain management by an expert team, as you represent. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Jasbreet Sandhu, Assistant Attending Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Assistant Professor, New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center. And Dr. Sandhu is going to address the overview of incontinence and recommendations to manage incontinence. And I just want to say that we've been doing these programs for many, many years and have really not addressed this topic in the past, and it's such an important one. And we're so delighted to have Dr. Sandhu on the call to actually address this topic and answer some of your questions as well. Dr. Sandhu?
Thank you, Carolyn, and it is a pleasure to be here to address these topics. I will start by saying that this is a very large topic, so I will give a very broad and brief overview. If you have any questions or would like more details, please ask during the question and answer session. So the overview of incontinence in patients with metastatic prostate cancer differs by whether or not the patient has a prostate in place, and this is whether or not it's been treated with hormone therapy, chemotherapy, or other therapies that are available currently. It also matters whether or not the prostate has been treated by radiotherapy or whether or not the patient has had radical prostatectomy or the prostate removed, regardless of the type of surgery they've had, whether it's open, robotic, or laparoscopic. Now, there are essentially three different types of incontinence, and this applies to all types of patients with urinary incontinence, but particularly for patients with metastatic prostate cancer, and I'll go through all three of them in the next few minutes. Urge incontinence is the type of incontinence related often with overactive bladder. This is something that is fairly common in patients who have had radiation therapy to the prostate. It's also common in patients who have prostate cancer in situ, meaning they have a prostate with prostate cancer that seems to be growing. This is rarely due to prostate surgery, but it can be in patients who've had radiotherapy after radical prostatectomy, and in rare cases, it can be simply because of a radical prostatectomy. The most likely cause of urge incontinence and overactive bladder is either injury to the nerves that supply the bladder or obstruction, which brings us to the next cause of urinary incontinence, and that's overflow incontinence. And overflow incontinence is typically caused by obstruction from the prostate. Typically, this is for patients with prostate cancer in place. So this is treated very similar to patients who have enlarged prostate, which many of you men may know about. Overflow incontinence is also common in patients who've had radiation therapy. By common, I mean I see a fair amount, not necessarily common as in out of all the patients being treated by radiotherapy. And it's also less likely, but present in patients who've had a radical prostatectomy. And those patients, it generally presents with what's called an anastomotic stricture or a bladder neck contracture. And the final type of incontinence is stress incontinence. Now, this is the type of incontinence which often presents after patients undergo radical prostatectomy. Depending on what kind of data you believe and what kind of measures you look at, this can range anywhere from 5% of patients who undergo radical prostatectomy to 60% of patients who undergo radical prostatectomy. The other common patient population that has stress incontinence is patients who have a prostate cancer treated with radiation therapy, then develop overflow obstruction and subsequently have treatment with what's called a TURP, which is a transurethral resection of the prostate. And I'll talk about this management in the next few minutes. So the management of incontinence, again, is broken down by what type of incontinence you have. So starting with the urge incontinence or overactive bladder type of incontinence, the mainstay of treatment in this type of incontinence is medical. So most of these patients will be treated with alpha blocker medicines, which are things like Flomax or Uroxetrol, along with an anticholinergic type of medication, something like Detrol or Vesicare, which you may have heard of. Now, both of these medical types have a fair amount of side effects, so those need to be addressed in detail, and I'm not going to go over them right now, simply in the interest of time. Another way of treating urge incontinence or overactive bladder is bladder injectables, things like botulinum toxin or Botox. Botox is very commonly used for cosmetic surgery, but it has recently been approved by the FDA for neurogenic detrusor overactivity. And what that means is overactive bladder caused by a neurogenic cause. Now, this overactive bladder due to prostate cancer does not necessarily fit that category, but we use Botox a fair amount in patients who have overactive bladder due to prostate cancer. There's also a role potentially for sacral nerve stimulators and possibly for larger surgeries such as bladder augmentation or urinary diversion such as with an ileal loop. The next type of incontinence that I'll talk about is obstruction or what's called overflow incontinence, and this is where patients' bladders are so full that they can't empty their bladder, and therefore they leak out. Again, the mainstay of treatment for this particular type of incontinence is medical. Alpha blockers are typically the type of treatment that's used, and that's either Flomax or Uroxetrol. And realize this is a patient with the prostate in place. So this is a patient that's either had a prostate treated with radiotherapy or has cancer of the prostate, but the prostate has not been removed. Another way of treating obstruction is with a TURP, and this can be either through an electrosurgical TURP or a laser TURP, and that's a transurethral procedure where we use a scope that goes through the penis and scrapes out the prostate, essentially. And the caveats with this is in situ prostate cancer, meaning prostate cancer that has not been treated, but locally, meaning with radiotherapy or surgery, may need retreatment. And it's been our experience that these patients last about 18 months before they need retreatment. Patients with radiation therapy who have a TURP also have a high rate of subsequent stress urinary incontinence, about a 15% rate. The other ways of treating overflow incontinence are self-catheterization, which is reasonably straightforward, but patients have to be willing to do it, or a suprapubic tube, which, again, the caveat for that is it needs to be changed. Now, stress incontinence is the type of incontinence that happens after surgery, and a lot of patients with metastatic prostate cancer have undergone surgery. Typically, it's treated initially with conservative management, pelvic floor muscle exercise, or Kegels, and we have very good data that shows that after 3 months, roughly 50% of patients do much better after a program of structured Kegels. The other treatments for stress incontinence are either an artificial urinary sphincter, which works very well for patients with moderate to severe incontinence, has about a 90% plus satisfaction rate, even though most patients will still need a pad. Reoperative rates are high with this particular surgery, on the order of 50%, but satisfaction rates remain very, very high. And outcomes may improve with increasing surgical or surgeon experience or patient selection. Male slings are the other type of treatment that we offer for stress incontinence. This is generally for patients with mild to moderate incontinence. They seem to work reasonably well, but we only have short-term data. And finally, major surgery and diversions are an option for all types of incontinence. We reserve these simply because we have much better treatments and much less invasive treatments. So in conclusion, there's a host of treatments and a host of different types of urinary incontinence that affect patients with metastatic prostate cancer, but most can usually be treated. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sandhu. Just an excellent presentation and really an inaugural presentation, and we'll definitely want to offer this again because it's so important and I know very important for all the participants on the call. Thank you so much. This is very important information. Our next speaker is Dr. John Mulhall. Dr. Mulhall is the Director of Male Sexual and Reproductive Medicine Program, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And he is going to address overview of sexual dysfunction and suggestions to cope with sexual dysfunction. And I also want to say, in terms of Dr. Mulhall's presentation, that although we've done many programs on prostate cancer, we have not included Dr. Mulhall or someone like him on these programs, and we plan to going forward in the future. And I actually want to thank Dr. Slovin for recommending all the different speakers today, because actually it really does make it a more multidisciplinary team and also allows you to get this wonderful information that you ordinarily don't have such easy access to. So I'm going to turn this program over to Dr. Mulhall.
Well, welcome, everybody. And first of all, thank you, Carolyn. And I'd like to applaud everyone for participating. I think one of the critical features in 21st century healthcare is proactivity on behalf of the patient. And I think we're not just here to educate you, but we're also here to empower you in your decision-making. Obviously, as everyone has stated, this is a very short presentation, and I can give you nothing more than a bird's-eye overview. And, of course, I think the most important part of this is going to be the question and answer session at the end. I'd like to thank Cancer Care for putting this together, and Carol and I spoke earlier on today, and I think if you think that a presentation on sexual health in men with prostate cancer is important, they may, in fact, consider doing an entire program on this. The World Health Organization has identified that sexual health is a right of every human being. And so, as others have said on this phone call, we have a multidisciplinary approach at Memorial, and we believe that your sexual health is important if you want to preserve it. For those patients, men who are sexual beings, for couples who are sexually active, absence of sexual activity and sexual health has a significant impact upon the quality of life. So as an overview, we're going to talk very briefly about testosterone production, how testosterone plays a role in sexual health, the effects of androgen deprivation therapy on sexual health, and then very briefly talk about treatments. As a disclaimer, I'm a urologist who specializes in sexual and reproductive medicine, and I have no role in the management of your cancer. So when patients ask me about their cancer care, I do not answer those questions. I direct them to the oncologist. and I never interfere with their care, even though androgen deprivation therapy is a very threatening thing from a sexual function standpoint. The core philosophy of my practice is realistic expectations. The ideal time for somebody like you to see somebody like me is before the initiation of therapy. There are generally four areas of sexual health that testosterone and androgen deprivation therapy plays a role. Erectile function, and the downside of that being erectile dysfunction. Libido and libido loss with ADT. Ejaculation and then orgasm. Erections work very simply through areas in the brain, transferring signals down the spinal cord to nerves that travel to the penis, the erection nerves. Your penis is composed of many types of tissue, but the predominant tissue there is a muscle. And if you think of the erection chamber and the tissue in there being a muscle, very much like your biceps, it needs to be exercised. And when men go long periods of time without exercising that muscle, that erection tissue undergoes degeneration. So chronic absence of erections leads to degeneration. You should think of that muscle like Swiss cheese. In the resting or flaccid state, the soft penis, those spaces are very narrow, and that's under adrenaline control. As men, we walk around during the day with a flaccid penis because the penis is full of adrenaline, keeping that muscle contracted. As we get turned on, those nerve fibers that I talked about coming from the spinal cord to the penis release a chemical called nitric oxide. That nitric oxide causes that muscle to relax. Those spaces, the Swiss cheese spaces, spread, and blood flows into those spaces, and that's how erection occurs. Testosterone is critically important for the health of that erection tissue. When we have low levels of testosterone, that erection tissue stays healthy. When we have no testosterone, as happens in men who are on androgen deprivation therapy, that erection tissue undergoes degeneration. You should think of it like putting your arm into a plaster cast for a year. What happens to your biceps? It undergoes atrophy. A very similar process occurs in the penis, except in the penis that atrophy is a permanent problem. So it's very, very common that when men are on hormone therapy, certainly for longer than 6 months period of time, that erection tissue undergoes permanent degeneration. The longer a man is on that treatment, the more likely he is to have greater levels of degeneration. We know that men who are younger are more resistant to that degeneration. If you're on hormone therapy, you are probably aware that you've lost your nocturnal erections. You're not waking up in the middle of the night, you're not waking up in the morning with erections, and that's because testosterone is the major mediator of nocturnal erectile activity. From a libido standpoint, the hormone that's most important to sex drive, us thinking about sex, not even acting on it, but just thinking about it, the most important hormone is testosterone. When we have no hormone or no testosterone, then we know from our data at Memorial Sloan Kettering that 86% of men have none or almost no sex drive whatsoever. What is interesting, however, is that 15% or so do have sex drive. So for those men, testosterone is not the most important thing. They are generally just constitutionally very libidinous men, and they continue their activity. Testosterone is required for the production of semen. It is routine that men on hormone therapy who have their prostate in place will have no semen after 4 to 6 months period of time. Orgasm is the final frontier in sexual health in the sense that we don't really understand how it occurs. We have far greater knowledge on erectile function and libido and ejaculation than we do on orgasm. However, it is routine that men who are on hormone therapy have a change, at least in the nature of their orgasm, and many men experience the absence of orgasm, whether that's physically or psychologically related, is unclear at this point in time. As Dr. Sandhu said earlier on, much of what we do and how we approach patients depends on what kind of treatments men have had preceding their hormone therapy. We see men who have had hormone therapy with radiation, men who have had hormone therapy before their radical prostatectomy, although there is no clear evidence that neoadjuvant hormone therapy, that is hormone therapy before prostatectomy, translates into improved outcomes. And then we see some men who come in to me who are on hormone therapy alone and have never had prostate surgery or radiation. From a treatment standpoint, I think the first thing is to assess the man's libido. Where a man has libido, it's easier to treat him. For the man who has no libido, there are two strategies that we use in the man who is partnered. One is to have a discussion with the partner about increasing assertiveness and proactivity to initiating sexual relations. And the other is to talk to the man about intellectualization, where he uses a calendar to look and see, okay, Dr. Mulhall says, I need to be getting an erection once a week, and he takes that off on the calendar to keep that muscle healthy, particularly in a man who's on short-term hormone therapy, because when he comes off his hormone therapy, his testosterone level will rise, and his erections will improve after that. Men who are on hormone therapy enter a state called sexual neutrality, where they don't think of sex, but they actually enjoy it when they have it. This is very similar to the postmenopausal woman. So we encourage men to be sexually active even while on hormone therapy. You could speak to your doctor about intermittent hormone therapy versus persistent or consistent hormone therapy. I'm not a cancer doctor. I don't know what the pros and cons are with regard to that. From a treatment standpoint, of course, we have the Viagra, Levitra, Cialis drugs, the PDE5 inhibitors. They work beautifully in men who have good nerve function, so those men, for example, who haven't had prostatectomy, and for men who have healthy erection tissue. For men who do not respond to pills, we move patients directly onto penile injection therapy, and I'm happy to answer questions about that later on. And for the highly motivated man who has failed pills, who has tried injections and either doesn't respond or who does not like that therapy, then there is penile implant surgery. Penile implant surgery in this population is reserved for men who retain very high levels of libido. So the most important messages that I want to communicate to you is that there are experts like me available to you to talk about your sexual health, that the ideal time to talk to them is before your treatment, and we have numerous strategies available to you to get you back to a sexual function and to have satisfactory sexual relations with a partner if you have one. Thank you very much, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mulhall. That was excellent and lots of very good information. I know that there'll be lots of questions for you because this is such an important topic and one that often people do not have access to someone like you to ask questions and to get answers and help. So this is really very, very helpful. Thank you. And now we have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board now. And if you could explain to the audience how to queue up and ask questions. I'm going to take as many questions as we can from the audience. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to move yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question is from Emil S. Your question, please.
Okay. If I had two questions to Dr. Sandhu. If I stop doing the Kegel exercises temporarily because of a muscle strain, will I become incontinent? How long do I have to do Kegels for the rest of my life? And the second question is, I have an overactive bladder only at night. I had my prostate removed. I'm on Vesicare 5 milligrams. I have to stop drinking water after about 6 o'clock, but when I do that, I run the risk of getting dry skin and dehydrating myself. What do I do?
Well, those are great questions. Thank you, Dr. Sandhu. Could you address those two questions?
Sure. And now what you bring up is a lot of different issues. One is what kind of Kegels to do. There unfortunately isn't a very standardized way of doing Kegel exercises. What we tend to do is have patients do Kegels for at least 3 months. We don't think you will become incontinent if you stop doing the Kegels. We think it just helps you improve your continence or hasten continence after radical prostatectomy. Now, there's been lots of studies that have looked at least one in particular that's looked at doing Kegels more than a year after radical prostatectomy, and it seems to help men who have not done Kegels for a long period of time but are still leaking, so patients with persistent urinary incontinence who do Kegels for about 8 weeks have about a 58% chance of essentially getting dry. So marked improvement in those particular patients. So to answer your first question, I don't think you will go back to being incontinence. You don't have to do this for the rest of your life. You just do a certain amount of Kegels until you are dry. Your second question was about overactive bladder at night. Now, some of that that's a tough question to answer. We see that all the time in patients who have neobladders after a cystectomy for bladder cancer. And patients after radical prostatectomy, that's actually not as common. So what you're describing is actually something that happens in about 20% of patients in the most recent studies. But what we tend to do in these cases is what you're doing, cut back the amount of fluid you drink at night, try medicines like Vesicare. The problem with medicines like Vesicare is they can give you a dry mouth. So we often have patients try sugar-free lemon drops and things like that. The other thing you've got to realize is depending on how far out you are from surgery, makes a big difference. So if you have a lot of bladder issues prior to undergoing a radical prostatectomy, then you can expect recovery of the nighttime urination later, meaning if you have a lot of urinary dysfunction and you undergo a radical prostatectomy, maybe 6 months from now, you will have a fair amount of nighttime leakage or nighttime urination getting up at night, and then it'll start to improve over time. So time is your best friend in most of these cases, but unfortunately, there isn't a very good treatment for that. We do use Botox in some men, but again, it's not indicated for this. It's not FDA approved for this.
Excellent. And we have a question actually from one of our online participants really about pain management and about the concern about taking pain medicines and becoming addicted to those medicines. And I wonder, Susan Derby, if you could address that question.
Sure. Years ago, we always told family members and patients when the issue of drug addiction came up that patients would never become addicted to these opioid pain medicines. But time has proven us wrong, and we know that in some instances, in a very low percentage of patients, drug addiction can occur, and this does occur essentially in patients who have prior histories of drug addiction, such as substance abuse problems related to illicit substances or alcohol. We do, however, treat patients who have substance abuse histories in very similar ways that we treat other patients. Namely, we reinforce the need for frequent monitoring and observation by a professional. So patients who do have substance abuse histories may require more frequent monitoring and assessment, but their pain is essentially aggressively treated like other patients.
Excellent. Thank you. And Trinita, our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Herb S. Your question, please.
You mentioned neuropathy and shingles, and I'm still trying to figure out whether the vaccine is a good idea or a bad idea while on hormone treatment.
Okay, excellent. Dr. Slovin, would you like to address that?
There is a small body of evidence, and I've seen this very sporadically, that in patients with cancer, with what we think is probably an altered immune system, that this particular vaccine would not be in their best interest. I can't cite rhyme or paragraph at the moment, but there's a small body of evidence that's out there. You know, patients in general have an intact immune system. You can fight an infection. You can weather really any sort of problem. It's just that there seems to be an issue that somehow this vaccine may not be the best choice for people with active cancer. Again, it has a sort of a long, detailed explanation, but I don't have the data on me to really give you all the information. I would say that if you have no evidence of active disease, not on chemotherapy, it's very reasonable. It's again, most of my patients have not been getting it. The relationship between your disease and the appearance of shingles is really not a direct one. Stress tends to do that. You don't even have to be on chemo or anything like that. We all harbor the virus. If we've already seen chickenpox, you can be certain that we're all harboring the virus in what we call the dorsal root ganglion. So it doesn't take very much for it to come out. You know, aggravation, your plane is late, or something can do it. So it's not always oncologically related. So if you are interested, I would discuss this further with your primary care physician. He will have access to the literature, perhaps, to assist you with that decision.
Excellent. Thank you. And we also sometimes recommend that people, in addition to talking to their physician, which is very, very important, the National Cancer Institute has a very helpful website. It's in your materials and a telephone number, 1-800, the number for cancer, that can be very useful also in terms of just getting just some basic information in addition as you speak to your physician as well. Now, our next question is from one of our online participants, and it's for Dr. Mulhall. Is Viagra ever used daily for maintenance of penile blood flow? And it seems to be coming from a healthcare professional who has a patient who feels more normal if he takes this medication daily.
Yeah, so this is a very hot topic in my field. The whole concept of erectile tissue preservation, or what's more called vernacularly penile rehabilitation. And so there is a single animal study, a rat study, that shows that when the rats had their testicles removed and had no testosterone, that when those rats were treated with a Viagra-like pill regularly, that they had less degeneration of their erectile tissue. I can tell you clinically, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, we treat all of our men who are on hormone therapy with regular use of Viagra Levitra Cialis. Now, that word regular can mean various things depending on what their insurance coverage is. But there is a suggestion that regular use of these agents may, in fact, go some way towards protecting the health of the erectile tissue, may promote nocturnal erections, which goes towards protecting the erectile tissue, and may, in fact, help men feel more normal, because some men, of course, are used to waking up with erections in the morning. So while the definitive data does not yet exist, it is an increasing avenue of research and kind of a movement within my field to conduct this penile rehabilitation approach.
Excellent. Thank you. And now we also have another question from one of our online participants, Fidata Sandhu, and actually it has to do with having blood in one's urine, and what could that be caused by, and what should one do about that? Dr. Sandhu, could you address that?
Sure. Blood in the urine can be due to a host of causes. The biggest things that we get concerned about in patients with or without prostate cancer is bladder cancer, simply because bladder cancer is much more aggressive than prostate cancer. There may be some evidence, although not that strong, that radiation therapy to the prostate may cause or may cause bladder cancer, which is harder to treat. So we at Memorial, we're actually pretty aggressive about determining the cause of blood in the urine. And the mainstay of determining the cause of blood in the urine is a cystoscopy, where we look inside the bladder, look inside the urethra and the prostate if it exists, and make sure there is no obvious source of bleeding. Now, there are some types of bleeding which are easier to take care of than others. Often in patients who have radiation, there's just some irritation of the base of the bladder, which can often be fulgurated or coagulated to stop the bleeding. That works in a lot of instances. In some instances, despite that, patients keep bleeding, in which case we have things like hyperbaric oxygen, which we can administer to patients who do not have evidence of metastatic disease, so probably not patients like a lot of patients on this call, simply because hyperbaric oxygen is one of these things that, while it helps heal and prevent ulcers and treat ulcers, it's also one of these things that may actually promote cancer growth. So it's not something we would use often. There's a host of instillations that we can use to prevent or to treat blood in the urine. But generally, the goal behind, if you notice blood in the urine, is to figure out where it's coming from, simply because if it is bladder cancer, then that's treated completely differently from other types of causes.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Slovin, would you want to comment on this? I'm going to ask you just to comment on a broader concept, because whenever someone has a symptom, they're always wondering, how do you figure out what's going on with it? And if you could comment on just that, it's a big word, differential diagnosis, but how do doctors and how do medical oncologists really figure out what's going on when they're seeing patients? And that's true for everyone on the call today. How do you figure out, for both the urologists on the call, for the oncology nurse, healthcare professionals figure out really what is, how to treat something, what is, when someone presents a problem to them?
I think that's an absolutely wonderful question, Carolyn, and is very timely. I think this really brings home the concept of a multidisciplinary approach. I think in our own right as healthcare professionals, we automatically have our own differential of what could be causing the problem. Somebody having bleeding, the first thing we think about is a urinary tract infection. Could this be recurrent prostate cancer? Is this a new kind of cancer? And the first thing we do after ticking these things off and calculating the probability that this is a likely diagnosis or unlikely is we pick up a phone, or we do an email, and Dr. Sandhu can attest to the fact that on many an occasion I will knock on his door, call him, email him, and say, look, I have this patient, this is what I think, would you please be kind enough to facilitate a further investigation? Similarly, if someone is in pain and I think that the standard treatments that I can offer this person is beyond the what the patient is experiencing, meaning that their pain is well out of proportion to what I would expect would be the diagnosis of their pain, first person I will call will be Sue Derby. So it's so important to understand that doctors don't make decisions alone. People are under the impression that it's we see one, do one, and we teach one, and that's the end of it. But we all learn on a continuous basis from one another, and that's really what makes taking care of a patient very rewarding, the fact that we're all trying to safeguard the same patient just with a variety of different approaches, and the fact that, most importantly, we all communicate with one another.
Excellent. And does anyone else want to comment on that? Because that's really wonderful in terms of, I think it's important for people to hear that, how this all works. Any of other speakers want to comment on this as well?
Well, this is John Mulhall. I mean, it's relatively easy for me because the overwhelming majority of men who come in with me with sexual problems who are on hormone therapy, it's directly related to their hormone therapy. That is not to say that there are not psychological factors that occur. Every man who has a physically based sexual problem, whether it's libido or erectile function or orgasm, has some secondary psychological component of that. And, you know, just as Susan was talking about the multidisciplinary approach to this patient population, within the field of sexual medicine, you have a urologist, me, but we also have a psychologist, Chris Nelson, who sits in the office, who triages patients, discusses with patients about strategies to improve the psychological aspects of their sexual problems.
Excellent. And, you know, and Dr. Sandhu or Susan Derby, do you want to add anything as well?
Sure. No, and Dr. Sullivan just said this. I mean, we actually talk pretty much daily about patients and how to manage patients. And some of the things that Dr. Sullivan would do, she would do prior to even sending the patient to me. And then when I do my workup and determine potentially other types of causes for, say, blood in the urine, as this example was, we would certainly talk to each other and determine what the best course of action is. The bottom line is we're all trying to take care of the patient, and we have lots of different ways of doing it. We just rely on each other's strengths in a multidisciplinary approach.
Just to put a little bit of a lighter spin on it, Carolyn, I think we can best say that, at least in our group, we're talking to each other either in the doorway, in the elevator, in the cafeteria, and it's one of those things, it's catch as catch can, because I know how busy my colleagues are, but that doesn't stop them from, you know, holding a piece of toast from their mouth and saying, okay, I'll answer your question. So it's such a privilege to work with people who really put patient care before everything else.
And I think... Yes, Susan, yes.
No, I think from a patient standpoint, it's very important, and I think it's very, very reassuring for patients to know that, contrary to many beliefs that patients may have, physicians and nurses do communicate all the time, often behind the scenes, but everyone here is really working towards a common good and a unified goal, and patients should be very aware of this and be very reassured that it's not one physician that's taking care of them, but rather a team of people, a team of professionals.
I might just add also, Carolyn, that this does not mean that we exclude the outside treating physicians as well. As part of the treatment armamentarium, we are all on the phone with these doctors so that they have an idea of what we're doing, what our thoughts are. And in many cases, we share the care of the patients with these doctors as well. So it's just not unique to us.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers today. You have been really outstanding, just an extraordinary team of experts and addressing such an important topic, and I think we're going to have you all back another time. I also want to thank all of you who've been listening and who've actually either asked a voice question on the telephone or who've sent us an email question about your questions. That's been very helpful to just really allow our speakers to address further some of your concerns. I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a workshop like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one hour program. And so I do want to review with you the services that you can access from Cancer Care. You have some materials about that, but I do want to remind you that Cancer Care has a staff of 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling services to support groups. And we do the support groups and the counseling on the telephone and online, so some of you may prefer one or the other group, but they're wonderful one or other modality, and they're very helpful to people. We also talk with families and with partners, and we also offer lots of different materials and lots of different workshops like this workshop. This workshop actually will be available on our website probably within a couple of hours of the program ending, and also is available on telephone replay as well. But we do have booklets that we also produce about these programs and fact sheets as well. Most importantly, I would not want anyone to leave this program feeling that you are alone. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and we're all here to help you. If you have a question and didn't get a chance to ask it, please call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. Our staff are here to take your questions and concerns and answer your questions or try to get you the information you need. If you think of a question in a couple of days, call us then. Remember also we're entering into a holiday period of time. We actually have entered it already. And so indeed this can be very stressful for people in general. So do take advantage of these support services both at the centers where you're getting your care and also, of course, from the staff at Cancer Care. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I just, I again want you to realize that you just have a whole host of services that you can access from Cancer Care, take advantage of them, as well as all the different support organizations that you have listed in your materials. Thank you all, and have a fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect, and have a wonderful day.